City. It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we're going to give you the latest on health and healing, and we're going to begin our program with a comment from Colin Todd Hunter from Global Research about embracing sustainability, forsaking meat and chemical agriculture. I think it's a very important statement, and I'll share that with you. Then the latest on health and healing. Then the remainder of today's program is, well, we keep saying, why in the world do they hate us? We're the most exceptional nation and people on earth. Okay. That's what Bill O'Reilly keeps saying. So I'm going to provide some possible answers. I will give my own commentary. I will then share those of Zaman Stazizi, Afghanistan, where chaos is king and plunder is privilege, from MEI content. I will also share that it's not about a film, The Real Reason Why the Middle East Exploded, from Consortium News. I will also talk about the human cost of Western fundamentalism. I will also explore some commentaries from Dr. Eliza Akla from Countercurrents on Israelis' war against Palestinian children. I will share commentaries on U.S.-sponsored Islamic fundamentalism, the roots of the U.S. Wahhabi Alliance, from Benjamin Schecht from Global Research. And my guest during all of that will be Professor Omid Shafi. He is the Professor of Islamic Studies, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He specializes in Islamic social and intellectual history and Sufi mysticism. He received his doctorate from Duke University and is chair for the study of Islam at the American Academy of Religion. He is also a member of the board of Pluralism Project at Harvard University, and he is the co-founder of Progressive Muslim Union. He is the author of Memories of Muhammad, Why the Prophet Matters, and Learned Ignorance, Intellectual Humility Among Jews, Christians, and Muslims. He will be here. He will be listening as I go through these commentaries of my own that I've written, as well as others. And then possibly individuals may share this, please, with Mark Levin and Michael Savage, Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham. Well, how about just everyone in conservative radio? They certainly have a right to their opinion. I am not challenging that at all, as I believe in freedom of speech. But I am challenging the idea that why in the world are they angry? I think there's a lot of legitimate reasons for their anger. Setting aside those who have political, theocratic, and religious zealot ambitions, how about everyone else, which is probably 95%? So I'll deal with that today. Because I do not see the mainstream media, nor for that matter do I see the alternative media really addressing the issue head on. Maybe out of fear, I don't know. We will. Let's begin. Those are only two topics today. It is my belief that we should be doing all that we can to lessen the amount of any animal product in our diet for many reasons. Each and every day I discuss the health consequences. Yesterday I mentioned that when you cook meat at any temperature, let's say above about 160, you're creating chemicals that can cause colorectal cancer. There's also association between hormone imbalance. But there are other reasons not to eat animal products. When global warming is mentioned, most people envision oil refineries and coal-fired power plants and cars or smoke-belching factories wreaking havoc with the planet. But according to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, livestock is responsible for 18% of greenhouse gases. Now let me put that in perspective. That is more than all the cars, the planes, the trains, and the ships put together. it could well be the case that going vegetarian, going vegan, may be the easiest and quickest way to lower your carbon footprint, reduce pollution, save energy and water. And according to a Dr. Pajuri, chair of the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, he believes that that is crucial to reduce or cut out meat entirely. It's one of the choices we can make to address climate change. Now, the amount of human meat we eat is immense. In 1965, 10 billion livestock animals were slaughtered each year. Today, it is 55 billion. More chickens are killed in the United States every year than there are people in the world. There are over 1 billion cattle alive, weighing twice as much as the human population. All that livestock needs land, which places pressure on wildlife habitat and forest. And livestock is the world's largest land user. Grazing occupies 26% of the Earth's ice-free terrestrial surface, and feed crop production uses about one-third of all arable land. Factor in that meat production requires staggering amounts of land, water, and energy compared to plant foods, and it's not surprising that a 2010 UN report explained that Western-type dietary preferences for meat would be unsustainable in the future, given that the expected rise in the world population. I discuss this all the time. China, India, Brazil, they want their meat. Why? Because Americans have meat. Demand for meat is expected to double in the near future. So meat consumption is already steadily rising in countries. And these countries at one time had to rely upon vegetable-based diets, not today. A person existing mainly on animal protein requires 10 times or 1,000% more land to provide adequate food than someone living on vegetable sources of protein. Far more energy is put into animals per unit of food than any plant crop because cattle consume 16 times as much grain as they produce as meat. It takes 16 pounds of grain to make 1 pound of beef. Animal farms use nearly 40% of the world's total grain production. In the U.S., nearly 70% of grain production is fed to livestock. If humans continue to eat more and more meat, it means we're going to place far more strain on land and water use and are also going to manufacture much more chemical fertilizers and pesticides. We will thus be creating far more pollution and greenhouse gases. Modern farming, I'm talking about both meat and non-meat production, is heavily dependent on chemicals, which leads to the emission of the greatest amount of greenhouse gases imaginable, carbon dioxide from the use of fossil fuels for machinery and to the production of chemicals needed, like nitrogen oxide, 300 times more potent than carbon dioxide, for the use of chemical fertilizers and methane from factory farming. Livestock generally contribute to about 9% of the total human-related carbon dioxide emissions, 37% of methane emissions, 65% of nitrous oxide emissions. This includes carbon dioxide emissions from deforestation in Central and South America. Why? It's simple. Let's say that you have an increased need for meat in China. So they go to Brazil and they lease or purchase land, humongous amounts of rainforest. They go in with giant machines. They rip out the root system, which is very thin. There's very little soil, and burn all that. That causes pollution. Then they put massive amounts of pesticides down and herbicides. And then they grow genetically engineered soy, which is then sold in tankers the Chinese own, and they take it back to China and they make it into animal feed so that their population could have it. Well, all that is using fossil fuel, and all that is contributing to our imprint. Consider that a gallon of gasoline is used to produce a mere pound, 1 pound, of grain-fed beef, and you begin to appreciate that meat production A, is very highly subsidized, and B, most of the cost of the meat you're eating are hidden from you, but it uses fossil fuel. It's a resource-intense industry. Now, according to the Food and Agriculture Organization, quote, ranching-induced deforestation is one of the main causes of loss of some unique plant and animal species in the tropical rainforests of Central and South America, as well as carbon release in the atmosphere. Just understand that every time you have a tree, the tree absorbs CO2. It's called a carbon sink. When you cut down the tree, there's nothing there to absorb, and it's released. So, what does this mean? A 2010 report from the United Nations Environmental Program, its International Panel on Sustainable Resources Management, declare, quote, impacts from agriculture are expected to increase substantially due to population growth and increasing consumption of animal products. A substantial reduction of impacts would only be possible with a substantial worldwide diet change away from animal products, end quote. According to the United Nations Population Fund, each U.S. citizen consumes 260 pounds of meat per year. We're number one in the world, needless to say. That's about 1.5 times the industrial world average, 3 times the East Asian average, and 40 times the average in Bangladesh. Scientists at Cornell University have advised that the U.S. could feed 800 million people with the grain that we give to livestock. But it's also water intensive. Meat production places a great strain on fresh water, which is likely to become an increasingly scarce resource in the coming years. John Anthony Allen, professor at the University of London School of Oriental and African Studies, argues that the average meat-eating U.S. citizen consumes 5 cubic meters of water compared to a half a cubic meter, which is what a vegan consumes. But not all meat is equally water-intensive. Beef requires 15,500 liters of water per kilogram. That's per kilogram, per 2.2 pounds, compared to a chicken, which needs 3,900 liters per kilogram. So, at the very least, consumers could think about reducing their beef consumption since it requires the most unsustainable water footprint. In her book, Stolen Harvest, environmentalist Vandana Shiva, who I quoted yesterday on this program, says that for every pound of red meat in poultry and eggs and milk produced, farm fields lose 5 pounds of irreplaceable topsoil. She also states that the water necessary for meat breeding comes to about 190 gallons per animal per day, or 10 times what a normal Indian family is supposed to use in a day, if it gets water at all. Now, the Great Ogallala Aquifer in the United States is the U.S.'s largest body of fresh water on Earth. The water in it is left from the melted glaciers of the last ice age. It is not replenished from rainfall. Author John Robbins notes that more than 13 trillion gallons of water are taken from the aquifer every year. More water is withdrawn from the Ogallala Aquifer every year for beef production than is used to grow all the fruits and vegetables in the entire United States. Robbins states it's only a matter of time before most of the wells in Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma, Colorado, and New Mexico go dry. In portions, these states become scarcely habitable for human beings. That is why, for example, I have stated repeatedly there are 16 states in the United States that are not going to make it. They're not sustainable. And we're not talking about, oh, in another 80 years when most people would be dead. We're talking about in the next 5 to 10 years. Of course, other arguments against eating meat or using animal products have been around for a long time, well before global warming and climate change appeared on the scene. Various religions and philosophical traditions believe that humans should not kill and maim and torture or exploit fellow beings for food or other purposes. but kill, maim, torture, and exploit we do. Take chickens just as one example from the many that could be used. For the past half century, there have been two kinds of chickens, broilers and layers. They have different bodies, engineered for different functions. Layers make eggs and broilers make flesh. Over the past 50 years, they have been engineered to grow more than twice as large in less than half the time. Chickens once had a life expectancy of 20 years, but the modern broilers typically killed around 6 months. Their daily growth rate has increased roughly 400%. All male layers in the United States, comprising about 250 million chicks a year, are destroyed at birth. Most are destroyed by being sucked through a series of pipes into an electric plate. Some are tossed into large plastic containers. The weak are trampled to the bottom. They're suffocated slowly. The strong suffocate slowly at the top. Others are also sent fully conscious through the blade cutters. But you don't see it. What you don't see, you're not conscious of. So if global warming isn't enough to make people think twice about going vegetarian or reducing their meat consumption, the cruelty we inflict on other species may well do that. In many respects, thanks to its various traditions, India has a definite head start when it comes to not eating meat. This is just as well considering 17% of the global population live in India on a mere 2 to 3% of the planet's land, and the country is already facing water shortages and dwindling wildlife habitat. You know, just as an aside, when we think of India, we think of its beauty, the Taj Mahal, Mahatma Gandhi. We think of the mystics and the yogis. We think of the sacred rivers and people bathing. We think of the Hindu, the fires where they send the ashes of their loved ones down the great rivers. Now go to India. Go to any city. You'll find the temples. You'll find the tourists visiting the temples. See how the illusion of what we want it and need it to be compares with what you see when you get there. When you have more people living in infrastructure that is decayed, broken, or simply non-existent. We're 760 million people. More than half the population, about 65% of the population, don't even have a toilet and have to defecate outside every day. The smells are horrific. Sanitation is virtually non-existent, except for those who can afford it. The people suffer. The government is utterly corrupt at every level, inefficient, and the oligarchs live much like the Maharishis and the nobles have lived in the past in very select gated communities, so they don't have to mingle with the population. Too bad that we can't deal with the reality of it and help them. But unfortunately, their government doesn't even allow itself to help its own. But during the last century, a radical shift took place in the world's food system. We went from a substantially sustainable based localized food production to a fossil fuel addicted industrialized system. Indeed, agriculture has changed more in the past two generations than it did in the previous 12,000 years. And almost every aspect of the modern industrial agricultural creates greenhouse gas emissions. Arthur James McWilliams suggests that many people recognize this impact and have turned to meat, dairy, and eggs from non-industrialized sources. The last decade has seen a surge in grass-fed, free-range, cage-free options. These alternatives typically come from small organic farms, which practice more humane methods of production and at least appear to be more in harmony with nature. But at the end of the day, you're still killing a cow or a goat or a lamb or a pig that we didn't need to. And while Vandana Shiva notes that hugely negative environmental impact of modern meat production, she elucidates further by arguing that It is modern agriculture's practices per se that must change. In this respect, the issue goes far beyond meat consumption and selecting a happy, smiley veggie meal at McDonald's or from the supermarket fast food freezer and the belief that we are doing ourselves and the planet some good. In India, people might like to consider that the next time they eat a meal of rice and vegetables, they could be taking in more than 40 times the amount of pesticides than an average North American person would consume for a similar meal. That's because India is one of the world's largest users of pesticides. Ladyfinger, cabbage, tomato, and cauliflower in particular may contain dangerously high levels of fruit and vegetables sprayed and tampered with to ripen and make them more colorful. Research by the School of Natural Sciences and Engineering at the National Institute of Advanced Studies in Bangalore reported that many crops for export were rejected internationally due to high pesticide residue. Shiv argues that this type of intensive chemical industrial agriculture, with its reliance on vast amounts of fresh water, fertilizers, pesticides, and the like, is destroying biodiversity and contributing towards climate change, not just in India but worldwide. It might have increased food production in the relative short term, but it's been at a terrible cost to the environment and is ultimately unsustainable. And in conclusion, modern industrial farms rely on fossil fuels, from powering machinery to petroleum-based chemicals used to create artificial soil fertility and protect against pests and stay off weeds. It is this use of fossil fuels on farms and the manufacture of fertilizers and other agricultural chemicals that negatively impact the environment. For Shiva, the answer is to return to basics by encouraging biodiverse, organic, local food systems. She argues that small, biodiverse, organic farms, especially in less developed countries, are totally fossil fuel-free. Energy for farm operations comes from animal energy and not machinery or fertilizers manufactured down at the local polluting chemical factory. And soil fertility is built up by feeding soil organisms through organic matter, composting. With this in mind, it's just interesting to note that the Devinder Sharma recently reported in India's Deccan Herald newspaper that some farmers in the state of Haryana have been learning about insects and are now using rejecting chemicals by pitting beneficial insects against harmful mealybugs. It's insect equilibrium, and it prevails. Making the required shift away from modern farming practices should not be that difficult. However, huge politically connected and often extremely unscrupulous agribusiness concerns involved in fertilizer, pesticide, and seed manufacture and genetically engineered seeds have a lot invested in maintaining the current high profitable system. And let us also not forget how the indigenous mustard oil industry was destroyed deliberately in India during the late 1990s by the invisible hand of international agribusiness. Let's not forget how Monsanto's entrance into India has devastated the lives of millions in the agricultural sector. But in finishing, let us end where we began, with meat. Author James McWilliams raised an all-important ethical issue by saying that it's not how we produce animal products that ultimately matters, it's whether we produce them at all. The dilemma he raises leads to some deep-seated questions about how we as individuals personally regard our mass slaughter and wholesale exploitation of living creatures we share this planet with. Even if our conscience can continue to live with this, the evidence is that in the long run, the ecology of the planet certainly cannot. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment with the second part of our program, my guest, and we will address this issue. Why do they hate us?
Took one look at you, and it was plain to see you were my destiny.
Open wide. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Professor Omid Safi is my guest today. He has become one of the most important postmodern Islamic thinkers in America today. He is Iranian. He is professor of Islamic studies, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, specializing in Islamic social and intellectual history and Sufi mysticism. And he is the author of Learned Ignorance, Intellectual Humility Among Jews, Christians, and Muslims. We are going to go to him in about 10 minutes, and I will ask for his input. But I wanted to share my own, as well as others that I have mentioned, to give a different perspective. I was listening, as I frequently do when I'm traveling, and I switch the channels in the car to listen to how they're handling, like Mark Levin, who was supporting the Shah of Iran and Mubarak, and saying that the people in these countries, the people meaning Muslims, were not capable of handling democracy, that they don't understand democracy. They're all religious fanatics, and every Muslim is a potential terrorist. This kind of mindset. And he has a right to those thoughts. I'm not questioning his right to his thoughts. What I'm questioning is, why don't we hear other reasons that could be legitimate? Let me begin by simply a very short overview. During President Clinton's clandestine efforts in Iraq, there was a paper that has now become public from the Defense Department that showed that they were intentionally taking out all water purification and electrical plants in order to cause the water to be polluted. They fully were aware that when you take out those plants, the population is going to suffer, but not Saddam Hussein. He had palaces, he had his own water purification systems, and all of his military and the ruling Sunni elite, they didn't have a problem, but the massive Shia did, and the poor did. And then their idea was, if enough children get sick and die, and this is in their own words, that they'll rise up against Saddam. Well, of course, that didn't happen. But over 500,000 children died. And when Madeleine Albright, who was both the representative at the UN as well as Secretary of State, when she was asked by Leslie Stahl about, was this sacrifice worth it? And she said, yes. And I remember watching it at that time, and I thought, what arrogance. What if it was your child that died because of this? Would you think it was worth it? But we don't think about other people of other colors and other ethnicities and other beliefs and other parts of the world who are not in power. We don't think what concerns them. It is of irrelevance to us. Now do the math. The average person living in Iraq has approximately 40 relatives, and many have more. But I'm talking about not just immediate family, but cousins and in-laws. So when you have one child die, you have 40 people who are going to be concerned. Now, since we invaded Iraq in 2003, and we were lied to, and we have allowed that lie to stand, and yet it should not, we were told, and most Americans believe that, well, they were given faulty intelligence information. But they were well-intentioned, and Saddam was a bad guy, so, you know, it's a good thing we went in there. That's the argument most give. Here's the problem. We now know that Dick Cheney had a group of ultra-neocons working inside of his office, but outside of any form of oversight, including hand-picking certain individuals out of the CIA and other intelligence agencies that would work together to create false intelligence that then could be used. And it became circular. Here's what I mean. Judith Miller, who's in the perfect place right now for her quality, she works for Fox. How good is that? That's karma. But she was the one beating the drums at the New York Times. She had an inside source. And the inside source was called Curveball. Here's the problem. Curveball was giving her information that she was saying about weapons of mass destruction, and then Condoleezza Rice and other people are saying, you know, the next thing we may see is a mushroom cloud. But who gave Judith Miller curveball? It was Dick Cheney's office. Well, was curveball legitimate? No. German intelligence and other intelligence assets inside the CIA had already shown that he was a liar. So he had no virtue at all in credibility. So therefore, if you use someone who you know is lying and you plant that person into a newspaper, and then Cheney says, the New York Times says, you know, we've got this, you know, and we've got these people out there. Well, hold on. Are you telling people you set this whole scam up and you're the one who fed? So it's circular. And that's how it worked. So when people said that we can find no proof of the yellow cake uranium in Niger, they simply dismissed that. So all the evidence inside the CIA is showing there is no Al-Qaeda 9/11 connection. Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11. All that was dismissed, and anything that could create a false story was put into place. So we have a war. What's the consequence? Well, the consequence is 4 million Iraqis were made homeless. Ethnic cleansing between the Sunni and the Shia. The Sunni were 20% of the population. The Shia were about 80% of the population, or 60% of the population. However, the Sunni and the Ba'athist Party had the power and therefore the privileges and were always first for the jobs and the best situations. So now there was ethnic cleansing. So remember, each day there'd be 100 to 200 to 400 bodies beheaded frequently, shot in the head, tortured every day showing up until finally there's no more people to kill. The neighborhoods that had been mixed now were completely either Shia or completely Sunni. 1.3 to 1.5 million have died. We're not talking about soldiers now. We're talking about civilians. Well, that's about 50 million people you've impacted. But you've already impacted 40 million earlier. So virtually everyone in the country could say that they have been negatively impacted and therefore have a reason not to like us. Then you allow the most firebrand of those, or those who have their own ideological or theocratic or agendas or political agenda, to manipulate it and to use it, because most people will not engage in that. They'll just carry their anger with them. And then take that into Afghanistan, and then take that into Somalia, and take that into Pakistan, where we control with our dollars everything that goes on. And then, of course, here's what the public does not know. And this is information that we need to put into the record to make it official, at least for the progressives. This is from Benjamin Schett, S-C-H-E-T-T, from Global Research. Quote, U.S.-sponsored Islamic fundamentalism, the roots of the U.S. Wahhabi Alliance. I'll only quote a small amount of this. The alliance between the United States and Kingdom of Saudi Arabia helped spread the ideology of fundamentalist Sunni Islam all over the globe. The majority of its victims are not citizens of Western countries, but citizens of countries that U.S. elites consider a threat to their economic and geopolitical interests. Many victims of Sunni extremism, often called Wahhabism or Salafism, are in fact Muslims, often with a secular, leftist, or national political background. Modern Sunni or members of Shia ethnic faith. The origins of Wahhabism, and it goes into Wahhabi ideology, serves the U.S. interest for several reasons. Its followers' archaic perception of society makes them reject any kind of progressive social change. Therefore, they are well-equipped to push back socialist, secular, or nationalist movements whose independence-oriented policies are a threat to America's geopolitical agenda. Although Wahhabism certainly is not representative of the majority of Sunni Muslims, Wahhabi Muslims are Sunni extremists, which caused them to maintain an extremely hostile stance towards Shiism. After the 2003 invasion of Iraq, which brought down the secular national regime of Saddam Hussein, a Sunni, the influence of Shia-dominated Iran increased and caused a certain power shift in favor of Shiite Islam in the region. Due to this strengthening Shiite representation, American activities in the Middle East in recent years have almost exclusively directed against Shia interest. The emancipation of deprived Shia masses in Iraq, Bahrain, Yemen, or Lebanon are contrary to aspirations from the side of the U.S., whose main allies in the regions next to Israel consist of repressive Sunni regimes and terror groups. In the case of Syria, President Bashar al-Assad, an ally of Iran, and a secular Syrian society particularly evoke the hatred of extremists. The fact that Assad belongs to the Alawite minority, a mystical religious group and a branch of Shia Islam, makes him unacceptable to Wahhabi purists. Portraying Syria ruled solely by an Alawi minority, as some mainstream journalists tend to do, would nevertheless be wrong. Among the Syrian top officials killed by a terrorist attack were Sunnis, Christians, and among the Alawites. It is therefore worth examining the background of these enemies of secularism, multi-faith society, and progress. And then he goes on to talk about how all this happened and how it evolved. So we don't look at this. This becomes too complicated for us. We don't look at our relationship with Saudi Arabia, which is the chief terrorist country in the Middle East. We don't look at this. We don't look at what we did in Bosnia, Chechnya, Libya, the Soviet Union when it was in Afghanistan, where we supplied and weaponized the Mujahideen because they were all extreme radicals. But that's one piece of the puzzle that we do not understand. Another piece of the puzzle we don't want to understand, it scares us, and that is what Dr. Elias Akeli says in Countercurrents. This is short but important. It's called Israeli War Against Palestinian Children. I'll quote this. The Israelis were not satisfied with the mere occupation of Palestine. The evictions of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians out of their country, the annihilation of Gaza Palestinians through a choking economic siege and frequent aerial bombardments, and the continuous confiscations of Palestinian land and the demolitions of their homes in the West Bank, so they had developed a very oppressive anti-Palestinian children policy that are aimed at intimidating, terrorizing, and traumatizing Palestinian children whose families dared to stay in the country. These policies that seem to be part and parcel of the racist expansionist ideology of Israel and its army aim primarily at driving Palestinian families out of the country for the sake of their children's future. And the secondary element is to traumatize and terrorize Palestinian children while very young so that they would not dare grow up to revolt against young men to revolt against Israel. Palestinian children as young as 8 years of age have become the primary target for the Israeli army in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli occupying forces impose severe oppressive measures against Palestinian communities. These include barriers and checkpoints between towns, impeding access to schools, universities, and markets. The army routinely demolishes homes, confiscates property, and forcibly evicts Palestinians out of their homes to give them to extremist settlers. When Palestinian young men demonstrate in the streets against such practices, Israeli snipers target children in the head and the upper body with live ammunition, causing many fatalities. When using rubber bullets, the Israeli soldiers break the casing of the bullet, making it more fatal. When chasing children, the soldiers use batons, hitting heads and extremities to inflict permanent crippling damage. Adopting the expansionist scheme, Israelis are pushed to forcibly occupy Palestinian farmland and establish caravan settlements on top of hills overlooking Palestinian villages. They then start targeting Palestinian villagers and farmers, especially their young children. The extremist settlers start by cutting down olive trees, burning harvests, and shooting farm animals. A similar tactic is adopted in East Jerusalem. The Israeli government wants to put its hands on Silwan, a Palestinian neighborhood adjacent to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, in order to build what Israeli officials call King's Garden. Palestinian homes in the neighborhood are being confiscated, their owners being evicted, and Israeli extremists moving in. At times, Israeli extremists force their way into one room of the house and start harassing the Palestinian owner. An Israeli settlement is being gradually built in the neighborhood. Such settlements in East Jerusalem constitute a violation of international law. These extremist settlers create tension and lead to constant confrontation and violent clashes. Israeli soldiers use these clashes as an excuse to raid Palestinian homes in the middle of the night, pull their children out of the beds, shackle and hood them, and literally drag them to police stations to be interrogated violently and abusively. An investigation conducted by the Israeli B'Tselem organization shows that within 1 year, at least 81 Palestinian children from Silwan neighborhood were arrested and tortured by Israeli special forces. The Defense for Children in International Palestine section conducts interviews of cases of Palestinian children being violently abused by Israeli soldiers as well as by Israeli extremist settlers. Their website is full of testimonies by such abused children and eyewitnesses. A search on YouTube.com under IDF Targets Children lists many videos showing such incidents. Breaking the Silence, an organization of former Israeli soldiers dedicated to publicizing the day-to-day actions of Israeli army in the occupied territories, has published a booklet of testimonies of more than 30 former Israeli soldiers who had disclosed their experiences of treatment of Palestinian children during their arrest, pointing to a pattern of abuse. A routine operation of the Israeli military forces in the occupied bank is called Straw Window. Straw Window includes midnight to pre-dawn heavily armed raids on Palestinian homes, breaking down the doors, screaming and shouting at family members, detaining all family members, including children, in one room, and using the home as a military post for as long as they deem necessary, and leave them home fully trashed. Family members, and especially children, feel terrorized, traumatized, and severely vulnerable. Another routine operation of the Israeli army, similar to Straw Window, is the pre-dawn raids on Palestinian homes to arrest their children, where they drag the child out of bed, tie wrap his arms, blindfold or hood him, and literally drag him out to military jeeps while kicking, beating, and verbally abusing him. With face pushed to the floor of the vehicle, the child is driven to a military interrogation center in East Israel, thrown in a dark and very cold cell for hours and days before being dragged to a room to be harshly, continuously interrogated by different officers for long hours while being tied to a chair in a stressing position. Such interrogation is accompanied by intimidation, humiliation, beating, verbal abuse, and threats of sexual abuse. The child is then led to incriminate himself by forcing him to sign a confession written in Hebrew, a language that is foreign to him. After long days and sometimes months of incarceration, he's dragged to a military court with both hands and feet shackled, where he is usually sentenced to months or years in prison plus monetary fines. All this time, while his family is not aware of his whereabouts, is not being informed of his legal rights, and is not represented by a lawyer. Many children are initially jailed with Israeli offenders who further beat, intimidate, harass, and at times sexually abuse them. These traumatic abuses have a great impact on a child's mental and psychological health and physical health and produce varying abnormal symptoms as a child develops. And Israel's abuse of Palestinian children had become so dramatic a phenomenon that it attracted the attention of nine eminent English lawyers who were led by Sir Stephen Sadley, a former judge of the highest British court, to visit Israel courts to study their practices. The lawyers then published their findings in a report titled Children in Military Custody, in which they accuse Israel of grave violations of the UN Convention on the Rights of Children that include violation of Article 2, discrimination, Article 3, the child's best interest, and Article 37, premature resort to detention. In their report, the lawyers criticized and greatly condemned the belief and attitude that were advanced to them by the military prosecutors that every Palestinian child is a potential terrorist. So, those are some reasons why, but not all of the reasons. The corruption in the countries where we exploit the government, and so you have enormous differences in the wealth of those who are the private contractors and those in power in Afghanistan and Iraq and Somalia and everywhere else, and yet the suffering of the average person. Let us now go to my guest who is standing by for his input. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you very much, Gary. It's good to be back with you.
Could you give us your perspective on what I just shared, plus your own perspective on why is there any legitimacy in many of the people around the world being angry with the United States, having nothing in the world to do with this film? And that's what the White House wants us to believe. The only reason they're angry is that.
Yeah, I think there is, in fact, a campaign of propaganda to mislead the American population. Look, the overwhelming majority of people around the world don't have access to internet, and they couldn't have possibly seen this crappy piece of hate propaganda, which really is kind of a recycling of old cliches against Islam that actually mimic a lot of anti-Semitic imagery and cartoons from 19th and early 20th century. The vast majority of people who are demonstrating haven't seen this trailer, couldn't have seen this trailer, and in fact, there's a very direct way of knowing what they're upset about. One could ask them. One could listen to them and say, what is it exactly that you're so upset about? And they would tell you, and time again, they tell us three things, and they tell us three things as loudly and clearly as what one can possibly hope. They're upset about the drone attacks. They're upset about the United States being the only country in the world that gives itself the extrajudicial right to kill civilians out of a clear blue sky. And we have done this thousands of times. We have done this in Afghanistan. We have done this in Pakistan. We have done this in Yemen. We, of course, publicize the few al-Qaeda leaders that we have killed in the process. We don't end up publishing in the process the ways in which we have also targeted wedding parties, where we have killed women and we have killed children, because apparently from 10,000 feet up in the air, we can't tell the difference between an al-Qaeda camp and a wedding party. But people in this part of the world know, and they believe, and I think rightly believe, that civilians have the right to live their life without having drones drop bombs on them. For as much as we hear about the sanctity of the freedom of speech in this country, and I am an ardent supporter of freedom of speech, it's what gives me the right to criticize my own government when I feel that my government has gone astray, and to criticize the Iranian government and the Saudi government and the Israeli government and every other government around the planet that violates the international norms of human rights. The freedom of speech is not the only freedom that we are entitled to. There is also life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and it starts with life. It starts with the right to live, the right to live a life that is endued and imbued with a sense of dignity, and a life that begins with the right of not having it sniffed out by unseen and unheard drones that belong to some other country. The first thing that people are upset about are these drone wars. The second thing are the number of U.S. military bases. And this is a difficult point for many people in this country. We have such a goody-good image of what the United States does around the world. And I'm not a hater, and there are times and places around the world that we do, in fact, do some good. But we're also the only country around the world that gives itself the right to plant, 150, 200, God only knows, military bases in every continent, in every corner of the world. And
no other country does this.
Yeah, no other country does this. No other country. China doesn't do it. Russia doesn't do it. Germany doesn't do it. UK doesn't do it. No other country has this sense of entitlement of imperializing the rest of the world. And what I simply invite the citizens of this country, the listeners of your show, to consider is that as hard as it is for our ears to hear, we have now become, and we have been for some time, an empire. And if that's something that grates on our soul, and if it's something that violates our sensitivities, then we should do something about it, and we should cease to be an empire, and we should become a responsible global member. We should become a neighbor in this very, very small planet that all of us inhabit. And the third and the final thing that time and time again people are upset about is the same thing that they have been upset about, and rightly so, for the last 40-plus years, which is the one-sided, blind, and fanatical, equally democratic and equally Republican support, unilateral support of the United States for Israel, at the same time that, hypocritically speaking, we're also positioning ourselves as the peacemaker. How can we be the peacemaker if we have given $150 billion worth of aid to one side and time and time and time again veto the rights of the other side, the Palestinian, every time that the international body moves in the direction of recognizing their rights? So I think in many ways, you know, this film is a smokescreen, and to the extent that Muslims around the world feel that their sensitivities have been offended and violated, I think they have every right to feel that they've been violated. Part of the question is how to respond, and how to respond with dignity. And frankly, as someone who is not only an American and also committed to international norms of human rights, but is also a committed Muslim, I also think that it's imperative that Muslims respond to this trailer and to this hate-filled propaganda in a way that upholds dignity and, frankly, the very model of ethical and moral and spiritual behavior that the Prophet laid down for us.
I appreciate that. One final question for you. If you're a young person and you're graduating from school in Egypt and you're a lawyer, true story, and there are no jobs for you, but if you are a well-placed family member and you graduate in the same class, there's immediately a very important job. Now, you're both 34 years old. You, however, have to go and sell fruit on a street corner in order to make enough money to buy food for your family, and it gets worse year after year. Do you not think that the hundreds of millions of Muslims living around the world and other religious backgrounds see what we've done for the last 50 years of supporting only those rulers, despotic military regimes that repress their people, circumscribe their rights, and have ruling groups that benefit tremendously with a disproportionate number of the people having little to nothing and barely subsistence. Even their most educated are struggling. And they are going to resent that, in my opinion, because that was American policy. We could have put conditions on the help we gave. We didn't. We knew that these people we were giving money and support to were using it to hold their own people from having freedoms and making their own lives better. That was done with full knowledge of the consequences. Do you not think that's not also a part of why a lot of people feel angry at American policy?
I think that's exactly right. The lack of economic opportunities in countries that have some resources, but they're choosing to spend their resources in areas that do not benefit people as a whole. And again, you know, one of the last points that I would like to make is to bring the message closer to home and just to remember that what's over there is also over here, and that this situation of resources being misspent on the war machinery is also something that we're seeing in our own situation here. And I'm a teacher by choice. And I teach 18 and 19, 20, 21-year-olds, and I keep telling them, look, there's a reason why there are no jobs for American college and university students when they graduate, and it's because the richest country on the history of this planet chooses to spend $4 trillion, over a decade period on war machinery. So when they tell us that we don't have enough money for housing, we don't have enough money for education.
We're coming up the end of our program for this segment. We're going to continue on with callers. You can listen at 832-280-3295, 832-280-3295, or progressiveradionetwork.com. I appreciate you very much coming on and sharing your points of view. Professor, thank you very much. I look forward to another conversation. I'm Gary Knoll, and that was Professor Omid Safi and talking about some, not all, just some of the reasons why they could be angry with us. And I'll have more on that on another program. Now let's hear your feedback. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And the remaining next 6 minutes is for you. While you're calling in, let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann. Oh, by the way.
Hello, Gary.
Yeah, one other thing. So many people called yesterday to get some free nutritional counseling. First, they don't counsel over the telephone. Secondly, they're telling me they're not taking any more calls because so many nut jobs and crackpots called, and it kept them from actually being able to help people. You're just going to have to show up between 11 in the morning and 7 in the evening, 7 days a week. One of or two of the four people I've hired to help you are going to be there. 89th and Broadway on the northwest corner of 89th and Broadway in Manhattan. Go ahead, Luann.
Well, you know, it's been some time. I mean, clear back in June, Gary, that you had your retreat. And we've gotten so many wonderful letters, and the letters just keep coming. This is from Rita. She says to you, "I'm so thankful and lucky that I heard about the retreat, even though it was last moment. I was overjoyed when I was selected to fill one of the few spots that were left. The week with Gary was fabulous and unforgettable. Never before had I felt as comfortable and at ease with a total group of strangers as during this week. We came from so many different backgrounds, yet we're united in our quest for improvement and enlightenment. I'm sure you heard a lot of feedback already, and I know I would echo what others have said so far more eloquently. One of the most memorable experiences was Gary's healing, the laying on of his hands and energy. He touched me most profoundly, and I experienced an exquisite reaction that I will never forget. These days, I must be content with keeping in touch with Gary through his shows on the Progressive Radio Network or on BAI. I hope to meet you the next time Gary has a premiere of a new documentary. I'll come up to you and introduce myself. Till then, I'll be taking my powders and juices, running, race walking, practicing yoga, taking care of my mother, and trying to make each moment special. Thank you, Gary and John and Mitch and everyone else who helped make the retreat happen." And this is coming from Rita. You know, it's very hard to put into words. I know when I go down to the retreats, it's an incredible experience for me, and I've been down there before, but it's always a new experience, and the people are what make it so rich when they actually do surrender to the moment and the energy and the people there, and of course, to your energy and your information. So it's always nice to hear from people who are, you know, who are experiencing this. So I just wanted to kind of let you know about that.
That's nice. Good. Okay. I'm being told that I don't have time to take calls because we are out of time. And so I want to thank you all for listening in and for all of you who listened overnight on KPFK for 6 hours. And in another 2 hours, I go on the air at our sister station, PFW, in Washington, D.C. I'm back on there now 5 days a week with an original show. Unfortunately, you can't hear it over the Internet, but we are posting those on Progressive Radio Network every late afternoon. So whatever I do there, you can hear on Progressive Radio Network. So you won't miss it because we're having some outstanding guests there as well and topics and insight. And it's all new. I don't do the same thing at noon that I there. It's all original. And coming up next is Eutrice Lead. And just a thought on this, I was looking at her numbers of how many people are downloading her program, how many are listening live every day, Monday to Friday, from 1 to 2. And if she were on BAI right now, she'd be the third most popular show on the entire station. That's in 2 weeks she's done that. And the callers, you listen to the quality of the shows, the guest. For 22 years, she was on BAI. And 20 of those years, she did talk back at a two-hour show in the afternoon. And then she hired her replacement, who's a really nice guy and does a great show, Hugh Hamilton. And now she's back after 12 years of being off radio. And it's really nice to have her back. So let's stay tuned for Eutrice Lead, a very powerful show from a very dynamic and insightful and sensitive woman who has a lot to share. I'm Gary Nall. Have a nice day, everyone.
Like sweet morning dew, I took one look at you, and it was plain to see.